This podcast deals with SOLI, Stranger-Owned Life Insurance, also known as IOLI, Investor-Initiated Life Insurance, or Investor-Owned Life Insurance. Is this a free lunch, or is this acid indigestion? How would you react if someone asked you if his company could purchase, own, and be the beneficiary of $10 million of life insurance on your life? What do you say to a client who's been offered free insurance who wants your advice? He says, I buy $10 million of insurance on my life, but I never lay out a dime, nor do I incur any out-of-pocket cost or risk because I'll be getting a non-recourse loan. If I die within the next 2 years, the money goes to a non-grantor trust for my spouse and children, and since the trust owns the policy, it will not be in my estate. At the end of 2 years, I can keep the coverage. If I pay back the loan, all the interest accumulated on it, any incentive I've received, and a termination fee. Or I can turn over the policy to the lender and all my debt, interest, the incentive I received, all is forgiven. Or I can sell the policy to a settlement company. I can use the proceeds to pay off the loan, the accrued interest, pay back the incentive, and if there's still a profit, I get to keep it, or at least a portion of it. And if I act now, I'm told that I get my choice of a Bentley or $250,000 of cash. All of this just for letting this company take advantage of my excess insurance capacity. I just have to put up my life. What can I lose? How can I get hurt? He asks you. Stranger-owned life insurance, again, also known as investor-initiated life insurance, also known as investor-owned life insurance. The promise is something for nothing. The reality, financing is a bridge, a cover for the life settlement market, at least in my opinion. In my opinion, there is a violation of the spirit, if not the letter, of insurable interest laws. Let's define the term insurable interest. It's a relationship with a proposed insured by blood or marriage or some kind of investment or business or loan nexus, a nexus such that the purchaser of insurance has more to gain by the insured's living than dying. The purpose of insurable interest is clear. It's to prevent gambling. It's to prevent trafficking on the lives of strangers. What's the result of a lack of insurable interest? And every state has a law regarding insurable interest. If there is no insurable interest, one of two things occurs. Either the policy is void ab initio, right from the very beginning, so the insurer pays no death benefits and returns the premiums. The other possibility, and this will depend on state law, is that the proceeds are paid not to the owner of the insurance, but to the insured's estate. Well, what could be so bad about free insurance? The insured dies, the insurer refuses to pay on the grounds of a lack of insurable interest. That's one thing that could be bad. Now let's look at the opinion of the Office of General Counsel of the New York State Insurance Department. That department recently said that non-recourse loans, at least the one that was presented to it, is an arrangement to facilitate the procurement of policies solely for resale. The transaction presented, this opinion states, involves the procurement of insurance solely as a speculative investment for the ultimate beneficiary or ultimate benefit of a third party. Part of the plan is to circumvent the public policy against stranger owners wagering on the life of the insured. There is, in the opinion of the New York State Insurance Department's counsel, no insurable interest, and these proposed transactions are not permissible under New York State law. Well, if there is no insurance under state law, it's not insurance under federal law, which means that the internal buildup, if there is any, is currently taxable. It means that death benefits are not income tax free. and it means the insurer may deny the claim or pay it to the estate rather than to the supposed investors, the investors who intended to get the proceeds. Now, the promoters contend that, no, that's all wrong, that the insured initiated the purchase of the policy and then transferred the policy, so insurable interest is moot under most state laws. However, in my opinion, again, the transaction would never have been considered by any of the parties had not the settlement company been given access to and made a favorable decision on the client's health information. Unlike the normal situation, there was never any analysis of the insured's type and amount of need for insurance. So this is not a needs-based sale. This is a sale based on the need to make a sale. Unlike the normal situation, no one, including the insured's personal attorney or CPA, requests or does an analysis to obtain the best company, the best policy, the best rates. It's highly unlikely the insured would purchase the type of policy used in these non-recourse loans if he intended to continue the coverage at the time of purchase. The structure of this whole arrangement, high premiums, high interest, high fees, repayment of the incentive, the whole structure makes it highly improbable, highly unlikely that the insured could or would continue the policy after 2 years. Unless the insured has a very short life expectancy, the parties know at the outset that the insured probably cannot afford to continue the policy. There's a question in my mind as to whether or not this whole thing is a debt, is really a debt, or is it disguised, is it structured to disguise a purchase by the lender? Again, unless the insured has a very short life expectancy, the parties know at the outset that the insured probably cannot afford to continue the policy. So the question is it a foregone conclusion? Is it everyone's intent that at the end of 2 years, the policy will end up in the hands of a party that never had insurable interest? If so, ask yourself this. Will the IRS claim that this was really a disguised upfront sale rather than a sale and debt extinction at the end of 2 years? But the whole point is that the promoter's contention that the insured initiated this thing and then transferred the policy once insurable interest was certain, this whole thing falls down. It's very much like a young kid, a teenager, sending a person into a liquor store to buy liquor for them, and he walks out and hands the liquor to the kid. Well, who was the real owner? Who was the real initiator right from the very beginning? Just as its name implies, it's investor initiated. It's initiated by the investors all along, and they never had insurable interest. Well, the promoter's going to argue, well, we met the letter of the law. The insured purchased the policy, had insurable interest on his own life. He had the right to transfer it. He kept the policy for 2 years. He had the legal right to keep it. And no one had the right to buy it or force the sale. But my point is that merely meeting the letter of the law is not enough. At least it's not enough according to the counsel for the New York State Insurance Department. Although the New York opinion is, yes, not legally binding outside New York, it certainly is highly influential. And it's clear that other insurance departments will be following this New York opinion very closely. Another area of concern, are there SEC issues? We have here a non-recourse loan and life insurance, which is packaged. It's packaged for sale. To whom? To hedge funds, to overseas pension funds, to settlement companies. It's viewed by everybody as a profit transaction. Even the insured assumes that there will be a sale at the end of 2 years at a profit. He or she is intending to be part of that profit, or assume that he's going to get some of that profit. We go back to the mutual benefits case, which dealt with investments in viatical and settlement contracts. And it clearly said that that such things, investments in viaticals, fall within the SEC Acts of 1933 and 1934. Here, the insured, in my opinion, is used as a step in the distribution of equity interest in life insurance on the insured's life. The client is induced to be both the buyer and the seller for profit of an investment. If an investor or a lender or other party is harmed, I think, since it is, or at least in my opinion, is an SEC issue, I think you can assume that you're going to have legal action against any individuals and firms involved in promoting these transactions. And by the way, if this is a security, will errors and omissions coverage apply? If this is a security, must the transaction be through a broker dealer? And if this is a security, are there potential criminal and civil penalties, mandatory NASD investigation, permanent loss of securities licensing? Does NASD Rule 2040 dealing with private securities transactions come into the picture? All these things have to be checked out by counsel. Let's talk about the taxation of the insured for a second. There are a lot of unanswered questions. For example, does the insured have taxable income? When the indebtedness is discharged, is there a gain, and if so, how much? What is the insured's basis? Does the cost of insurance that the individual, the insured, is receiving, does that lower his basis? If so, how much? Is interest added to the amount realized when you calculate your gain? I think it is. Is this capital gain, as the promoters claim, or is it ordinary income? Let's go to this non-grantor trust. This whole thing is typically set up through either a partnership or a non-grantor trust. And the promoters claim that, look, when this whole thing ends, if there is any income during this period of time, that since the trust is the owner, the trust has the liability. But since there's no asset inside the trust, we don't have anything to worry about. You won't be personally liable because it's the trust that owned the policy. It's the trust that's responsible for the tax. And so, you know, don't worry. Let the trust worry. Well, is the trust really a non-grantor trust? And if you haven't checked, how do you know? Will the service look through the trust and find the grantor personally liable for the tax liability? Is there, since the promoter has said, don't worry, the trust is an empty bag at the end of the time, ha ha ha, the IRS has nothing to go against, is there really a conspiracy with the insured to evade income taxes? Again, the promoter tells the client that even if there is income, the trust has no money, so the IRS can't collect. Let's go to another issue. Is this an illegal rebate, or is an illegal rebate part of this transaction? The insured has been promised cost-free coverage for 2 years. Clearly, that's an arguable inducement to enter into a transaction. At least it was, according to the New York State insurance opinion. If it is an illegal rebate, will malpractice carrier, will the insured, will the insurance agent's malpractice carrier cover it? If it is an illegal rebate, how much is taxable to the insured? In one case called Sutter, the entire premium, not just the cost of insurance over those 2 years, but the entire premium was taxable to the insured. Let's switch topics. Again, I feel that this is a very, very dangerous transaction because the client has no control over the ultimate owner of the policy on his life. Let's assume it's a $10 million policy. The first question you have to ask is the original buyer reputable? Well, we thought that Enron was reputable. We thought that WorldCom was reputable. We thought the Adelphia people were reputable. Will the original reputable buyer, let's assume that the original buyer, a hedge fund or a life settlement company, is reputable, but they find that they can make more profit or they need some cash, so they immediately, just like a mortgage company, sells this contract to somebody else. Maybe it's to TSI. Who you're wondering is TSI? Well, it could be Tony Soprano Incorporated. And remember that the return on the investment when this policy is sold varies inversely with the number of years that the insured lives. This is, after all, a contract on the insured's life. Ask yourself if there are laws in your state that limit or monitor who the buyer of the policies can be. In most states, there is absolutely no law whatsoever that limits who the eventual buyers, and it can be sold over and over and over again. If you don't believe that, check the internet. Elliot Spitzer is currently investigating sales of policies from a legitimate life settlement company where the buyer tried to hide the sale. In fact, both parties didn't make it very public that the life settlement company was immediately turning around and selling policies it had bought to somebody else. If the insurer denies a claim, who's going to sue whom? And will your client be sued? If the insurer pays money to, well, if it pays the proceeds to the estate rather than the investors, and that can happen, if you don't believe me, check on the Walmart case. If the insurer does pay to the estate rather than the investors, what are the investors going to do? Will they sue the estate? Clearly, the proceeds, if it's paid to the estate, will be includable. Let's suppose the client has no put. In other words, the client contractually has no right to demand that the settlement company or somebody else buy the policy at the end of 2 years. Let's assume that the interest on the loan is very high and getting higher because the loan is getting greater. Let's assume the client at that point can't afford or doesn't want the policy at the end of the free period and can't find a buyer. Why wouldn't he find a buyer for a policy on his life? Well, perhaps a settlement company will say, this guy's too healthy. His life expectancy is outside the parameters our life settlement company deems profitable at that time. And then there are also intangible losses. The insured loses the opportunity for objective analysis of true insurance needs. Nobody's going to say, here's what you really need, here's what you really should have. The insured loses the opportunity for an objective analysis of the best possible policy or insured. Nobody's checking to see if this is the best possible policy for this particular client, or we've done business with an insurer that's a AAA rated company. Let's talk about representation. Was the insured represented at all? Most of these promoters say, oh, of course, these people are wealthy people, they're sophisticated people, they're well represented. Well, let's ask that question. Was the insured well represented? Did the insured, and these are typically people 72, 73, 75, 80 years old, do they really understand the nature and full extent of the risks? Is the loan really non-recourse? Did the insured guarantee, represent, or make some affirmation as to insurable interest? Did the insured, anxious to obtain, hey, this sounds really great, $10 million of free insurance, did the insured accidentally make a substantial misrepresentation? If so, what is the liability of the insured's estate if the insured denies coverage at the insured's death? Will counsel be paid adequately for proper research and due diligence? And we're talking about a lot of time here. What is the extent of counsel's risk if the transaction, and we're talking about a $10 million policy or a $5 million policy, what if this transaction goes south? What is the extent of counsel's risk? Counsel says, oh, sure, it's fine, no problem. What happens if a party to the transaction says, you didn't tell me? To what extent are you capable, are you willing to opine on insurable interest, contract law, securities law, trust law, and tax law, because all of these things are involved? Did the promoter provide you with a more likely than not opinion from their counsel on these issues and on these outcomes? Are you willing to have you provided the client and the client's other advisors with a letter outlining the risks and uncertainties? Now, of course, after all these things are presented, you're going to hear promoters say, well, that may be true of other companies and other promoters, but Ours is different. Well, check to see if in fact they really are. Finally, I think there's some ethical uncertainty here. Even if something works, it doesn't necessarily mean it's right or it's right to do. Even if the transaction meets the letter of the law, it may still offend a notion of sound public policy. Remember that every state has insurable interest laws. Remember that no state, to my knowledge, has repealed its insurable interest laws. So why then does it make sense, ethical sense, to get around these insurable interest laws when there are public policy reasons for them? The bottom line here is more questions than answers. And I think it's very important to distinguish between financing of needs-driven life insurance, which I have no problem with whatsoever. If the purchase of insurance is driven by the client's proven, documented needs, there's no reason why, if it makes sense to finance the purchase of that insurance, I have no problem with that whatsoever. But I do have a great problem with the need to make a sale, stranger-owned, investor-initiated life insurance.